Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on Heritage Radio Network. Today, we will be talking all about a report that was released by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group's Education Fund. It coincided with the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works hearing, which was called The Impact of Federal Environmental Regulations and Policies on American Farming and Ranching Communities. The U.S. PERG Education Fund is a nonprofit working to protect consumers and promote good government. The report is titled Reaping What We Sow, How the Practices of Industrial Agriculture Put Our Health and Environment at Risk. And it details the problems and offers common sense solutions. One of the co-authors of that report is Kara Cook Schultz. And I'm so pleased that it has brought her to our show today. Hi, Kara.
Hi, Jenna. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. Why was this report issued and the committee hearing held now?
Well, every 10 years, our congressional representatives are responsible for passing something called the Farm Bill, which outlines how much money is going to go from the U.S. government into various farming practices and into the farming economy. And 2018 is the year when we're going to be talking about this farm bill and hopefully getting it passed. So it seemed like a good time for us to put out this report about the current state of farming.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about responses to the report from the full committee a little bit later in the show. But first, can you just give us a broad overview of kind of what you outline as the few main issues with our ag system today? Can you just, you know, tell us exactly what's wrong with our entire food system in four sound bites?
I will give you some highlights, or rather lowlights. So a couple of things are happening in farming that I'm very concerned about and that our organization is concerned about. The first one is the use of chemicals in farming. This year, for example, there is what scientists call a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, and this dead zone is caused by the use of nitrogen and other chemical fertilizers. The dead zone is the size of Rhode Island, and like I said, it's in the Gulf of Mexico, where the Mississippi River flows into the Gulf of Mexico. And when I say a dead zone, it's a place that is so full of algae blooms that fish can't live there, other animals can't live there. It's really terrible for, you know, our water, for our oceans, for our fish, and for fishermen. Mm-hmm. So that's one huge problem. Mm-hmm. Another problem is the use of pesticides in agriculture. We use 2.5 times more pesticides now than we did in the 1960s, and we haven't seen the same kind of uptick in production where we're using these pesticides. We have the overuse of antibiotics on mm-hmm. factory farms. We want to make sure that our antibiotics are safe and effective on humans, but unfortunately, the more we use antibiotics on healthy animals on factory farms, the less likely those antibiotics are to be useful and effective on humans. So those are some major problems in farming right now.
You write in the report that farms have become larger and more specialized. What does this look like in practice, and how does it kind of relate to some of the issues that we're seeing right now that you, you know, those three issues, for instance, that you talked about?
I think most of your listeners will know that there's been a big movement in farming in the past couple of decades or the past 100 years where we see fewer and fewer people out actually farming. And there are a couple of reasons for that, but because fewer people are farming, we're seeing more large, what we would call factory farms, and even if it's just one, you know, family farmer, he's going to own more farmland than he would have 40 years ago. So in 1987, for example, the average farm was 600 acres. It's now 1,100 acres. So we see an increase of, you know, about 40% since just the 1980s.
You know, what does that kind of look like on an everyday basis? So fewer small family farms, fewer vegetable production, more specialized commodity crops.
Exactly. That's exactly what we see. A couple of things happen when you have these really large farms. It makes it easier to spray pesticides and to put nitrogen into the soil and chemical fertilizers into the soil because you just have longer rows of corn, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason why we see these bigger farms is because farmers can grow much larger fields of just a few crops. So back in the 1980s, you would see the average farmer would grow three or more types of crops. Now, because it costs so much money to have the right kind of tractor, the right kind of combine, the right kind of pesticides, the right kind of seeds that go with those pesticides, that costs a lot. That means you can really only grow one specialty crop, which is probably going to be corn or soy. Most of the food that we grow in this country is actually corn and soy and not, you know, your idea of like vegetables and orchards. So we're seeing larger farms growing just one type of crop.
I mean, I think that there's a very common argument out there that with a rapidly growing population, we need these modernizations and industrialized agricultural practices to be able to, quote, feed the world. So how does that kind of, you know, how does that match with what you talk about in this report? You know, I mean, how do you basically reconcile those two arguments? Like we need larger farms to be able to produce more food.
Yes. So I would like to emphasize that it's very important that we have enough food in this world. But we also, the problem is that right now we're not actually growing the type of food that would feed the world. So like I said, corn and soy, that composes 54% of the type of food that we're actually growing in this country. Most of that actually either gets wasted. A lot of it goes to fuel. It goes into ethanol instead of actually to feeding people. Not most food, but 30% of food in this country is actually thrown out right now. So there's a couple of problems with how we're actually growing food on our farms. Like, we're not growing the variety of foods to really make healthy minds and healthy bodies. We're not, and a lot of the food that we are growing is getting dumped, or it's going into fuel rather than into people's bellies.
One of the things that I read was that more than 700 pounds of food are wasted per person in the U.S., and I thought to myself, like, is that right? Could that figure possibly
yes, I mean,
be accurate?
I think when we envision that, we envision ourselves throwing up 700 pounds of food, which isn't really accurate.
I eat a lot, but...
That's how much food gets tossed in this country, not how much food you toss in this country. So a lot of that, you know, gets dumped at various places along the production line. It'll get dumped because it's not the pretty kind of fruit or vegetable, right? It gets dumped... before it even hits the market, or it gets dumped by the grocery store, It gets dumped by the restaurants. And then at home, yes, we do dump a lot of food after it goes bad because we don't eat it fast enough.
What are some of the federal policies, you know, like more specifically, that have kind of encouraged this way of production, driving farmers towards these larger, more specialized farms?
So a couple of things have happened over the past few decades that have created this system. There's something called crop insurance subsidies. So what happens is that the federal government pays subsidies to farmers to have crop insurance for when their farm might fail, or when the crop that year might fail. Mm-hmm. In theory, this sounds like a really good idea. We're making sure farmers are protected against loss. The problem and what happens in practice is we see farms consistently not creating the crops that they're claiming they're going to create. For example, there are farms in wetlands that are allegedly going to be growing corn in places that are flooded each and every year. Mm-hmm. So for the past 15 years in some farms in South Dakota, they've claimed complete crop loss on those farms. So for 15 years, they haven't grown anything, and yet we've been paying these subsidies. So what these subsidies do is that it encourages farmers to grow food in places that doesn't make sense for them to be growing it, and then doesn't encourage them to actually produce the food. Mm-hmm. So that seems like a very bad system that we need to be fixing.
And is that all farmers, or is that just farmers of, like, a, you know, of corn, for instance? Like, do we see vegetable, especially crop producers doing the same thing, kind of claiming the same, you know, making the same false claims, insurance claims?
Well, in order to get insurance, you have to be able to show that this crop is going to be a cash crop. And so it's harder to show that vegetables are a cash crop than it is to show that corn and soy are a cash crop, because we know that soy and corn are cash crops, and crop insurers know how to handle insuring those kind of farms. So I wouldn't say it's, you know, a particularly evil form of farmers going out there and trying to claim certain crops. It's not like vegetable farmers versus corn. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's that the whole system is geared towards encouraging farmers to grow corn and soy in the first place, and then getting this insurance that will encourage them to grow corn and soy in places where corn and soy will not grow.
I mean, it seems like crop insurance in general is something that's really important for farmers by and large. There are factors that are very much outside of their control, which, you know, directly affect their ability to their livelihood. So what would a more appropriate system look like? And can that really happen? I mean, that seems like a really large ship to turn around.
So one thing that we suggest in our report is that farmers who participate in subsidized crop insurance should have to adopt best practices that reduce soil loss and prevent water pollution. So, for example, in order to take part in this subsidized crop insurance system, you can't grow corn in a wetland that floods every year. That would be one idea.
That's a good idea.
So it would require farmers to take sensible steps before they can get insurance. And whether or not that could happen, we think that it can. We think that a lot of average farmers are realizing that this is silly, that this is absurd, that this is harmful to their land and to the future of farming. And so we think if we can get enough farmers, we can get enough average people to understand what's going on in this country, we can really move the needle on the farm bill in 2018.
Does that kind of demonize farmers in a way? I mean, you know, I think that my impression is always that they're operating on razor-thin margins, whether or not they're growing commodity crops or specialty crops. And, you know, how realistic is it for a farmer who is used to kind of getting some sort of an income, even though they're not growing the crops or say they're growing? I mean, it seems like they're reliant on this. It's almost like a subsidy from the government to survive.
Yeah, absolutely. I do not want to demonize farmers. I think that they're stuck in a system that is screwed up and that is set up to be an advantage to crop insurers, to be an advantage to things like large agrochemical companies, mm-hmm. An advantage to makers of, you know, tractors and combines that are very expensive, rather than a system that's meant to benefit the average farmer. Because the average farmer oftentimes will want to grow crops that are good for the soil, that are good for the future of their property, that would be good for their kids to someday take over the farm. And right now, a lot of farmers aren't sure that they can see that as the future. So the problem with the system is that it's set up for these big, giant factory farms, big, giant purchases of chemicals and equipment rather than encouraging the growth of the best kinds of food that's the best for the farmer, for the consumer, and for the land.
In terms of supporting things like crop diversification, which is one of the things you kind of champion, which will help return nutrients to the soil and adopt sustainable, just in general, other sustainable practices in order to receive federal funding, how, I mean, that sounds expensive. Is there, you know, I mean, you look at like the organic designation, right? And that's even, I mean, that's too expensive for a lot of farmers to be able to to apply and receive the official designation. So what kind of support would you advocate for to help make these recommendations a reality?
So one big thing that we'd like to see is money going towards conservation and sustainable programs that the U.S. government has already set up, but that they're underfunding. And what that would, if we would fund those programs better, that means that people at the USDA, soil scientists and agricultural scientists could be helping farmers figure out the best plan for their property, figuring out where to grow which type of crop, whether or not it's up on a hill or down in the valley or near a river. You might have make a different decision about what's the best type of crop to grow. And yeah, that does take time and it does take money. But the reason we think it's such a good idea is that over time, that actually saves the farmer money and leads to higher production. So it does take upfront time. It does take upfront consideration. But we've talked to farmers who have done it and who've put in, you know, that upfront work, and they've seen much more successful farms overall. And to be clear, I'm not talking about turning these farms into organic farms. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about turning these farms into sustainable farms, which might mean doing a variety of making a variety of decisions on the farm that might not be quote unquote traditionally organic, but that will lead to using a lot less pesticides, that will lead to using a lot less chemical fertilizers, which overall would be better for our water and for our food.
Some of the things, the other kind of common sense solutions that you talk about relate to the renewable fuel program and antibiotics in food production. So I'm wondering if you can kind of break down, first of all, I don't really hear a lot about the renewable fuel program. I mean, that could just be me, but can you just like give us a bit of a breakdown of what it is? It seems like a policy to me that an example of a policy that like had good intentions, but really ended up having negative repercussions. So can you tell us about like what that is and then how that fits into your broader strategy for improving the agriculture system?
Yes. I mean, I remember when they first passed the renewable fuel standard a little over a decade ago. I was so excited because we had this vision that we were going to be able to use food instead of oil in our gasoline, and we were going to be able to power our cars using corn, and that sounded really exciting. Unfortunately, it has not paid off, as you said. The renewable fuel standard, the idea was that the U.S. government was going to require a certain percentage of all of the fossil fuels sold in this country to contain some amount of biofuel, which means like basically means corn ethanol. Mm-hmm. What's happened with this requirement is that now we're seeing it over 8.4 million acres of land that formerly didn't contain any cultivation, that didn't contain any farms, now contains corn. Mm-hmm. Because there's all this money going towards creating corn to put it into our gasoline. The problem is that this has not actually reduced greenhouse gas emissions. It turns out that it's not a very renewable fuel, and that it's just as harmful as fossil fuels. And not only that, it means that we're destroying wetlands and grasslands to plant more corn. So we are monoculture. We just have one type of crop that we're growing all over the country, just corn, 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 corn. Mm-hmm. We're dumping all kinds of pesticides on this corn. We're putting it in our cars. It's still causing greenhouse gases. We're still causing global warming. And then we're also destroying wetlands at the same time. So it seemed like a really great idea. It had some really good intentions, but it hasn't actually led to any of the promises that we were hoping for when it was passed.
Yeah, seems like it made matters worse.
Yes, it made matters significantly worse for our wetlands and for our grasslands in this country.
And then I also kind of want to just talk just briefly about, you know, drilling down into the environmental issues that, you know, are contending, you know, that we're seeing in terms of our system. And you talk about like soil erosion, topsoil erosion, and aquifer depletion. So what's the issue with each of these, and how do the solutions that you propose relate to ameliorate these challenges?
Well, I hate to keep talking about how terrible corn can be, but the problem with
but it is.
Like growing corn over and over again is that you are not putting nitrogen back into the soil. That's part of why we keep using chemical fertilizers. And so what's going on with just using the same type of crop over and over again, throwing a tractor on top of it, is you're eroding the topsoil. You're getting rid of the thin layer soil that's on the top that's good for growing and that has a lot of nutrients in it. So then when we're increasing the amount of the size of our fields, what we're also doing is we're not putting any breaking points in the fields. So some states, for example, require you to put trees and hedgerows in between fields, which is good. That keeps your topsoil from blowing away. Mm-hmm. But many states don't require that, and it's not a federal requirement for most farms. So we have these huge cornfields without anything stopping the wind and the water and floods from just blowing in, getting rid of all of the topsoil. And this topsoil, by the way, takes literally thousands and thousands of years to create.
Wow.
So it's not like we can just be like, oh, let's dump some more topsoil on it, it's okay.
Right.
This topsoil goes away and it doesn't come back. So we're getting rid of the topsoil, which we need to have farms in the long run, right? Like 20 years from now, we need that topsoil
right.
to grow more, you know, whatever it is we need to grow, whether or not it's corn or whether or not it's lettuce or wheat, we need topsoil. So that's a huge problem. Then also, we take something like corn that takes a lot of water, it takes a lot of irrigation. Where is that going to come from when you're in the middle of the Midwest and there's no water, you know, in the middle of July? Well, you go to your aquifers. So my home state of Oklahoma, for example, uses the Ogallala Aquifer, and we've pretty much depleted it, and scientists have been warning us about this for decades. But if you don't have any water anywhere else, where are you going to take it from the aquifer?
Wouldn't any crops require irrigation, or are you saying it's just because we're growing certain crops in inappropriate regions for that crop?
Exactly, yeah. We are not doing the kind of soil science and agricultural science that would make us determine what should we grow in this particular grassland? What should we grow in this particular area that maybe we shouldn't grow anything because maybe it's the desert?
Mm-hmm.
And being from Oklahoma and having grandparents who lived through the Great Depression and still seeing land that's been, has been abandoned since the Great Depression, I can see in my mind very clearly, like, let's not grow anything here. This is just, this is a wasteland.
Yeah.
But then a couple years later, you'll see a wheat farmer come in and grow wheat there. And you're like, wow, how is that possible? Well, it's possible because of aquifers. So that can be scary.
It's funny. I think that there's a general misconception in this country that vegetable production in this country happens in the Northeast and California, right? But I think that, and then you see a lot of commodity crops in the middle. But I think that there's a big misconception that that's what has to happen, you know, in terms of our, you know, the weather practices or geology or whatever, you know, the environment like requires it. But I think it seems like you can grow much more in many, many more vegetables throughout the country.
To go back to my grandparents' example, you know, 10 miles from my grandparents' farm was the desert, but they lived near the Red River. So they would grow a wide variety of fruits and vegetables because they live near the water.
Mm-hmm.
So there are places and particular parts of the country, all over the country, where you can grow a variety of fruits and vegetables. And that's absolutely the case. But it does take some thought and some planning to figure out where you can grow what. And that's the key that we're missing right now in a lot of farms, because farmers are almost required to grow these cash crops and they don't have a lot of other choices.
And they might not, you know, might not be the best thing for the land. Sounds like.
Exactly.
Okay, so we're going to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we'll be joined by Seth Watkins, who is a fourth-generation Iowa farmer, implementing the types of sustainable farming practices proposed in this report. Stay tuned.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sertori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth generation cheesemakers combine old world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Kara Cook Schultz about the report she co-authored called Reaping What We Sow, How the Practices of Industrial Agriculture Put Our Health and Environment at Risk. I also now want to welcome to the show Seth Watkins, who's a fourth-generation Iowa farmer, to talk a little bit about how he is implementing some of these practices suggested in Kara's report. Seth, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why did you decide to stay in the farming industry? Can you give us a little bit of a background about how you got involved and what made you decide to pursue this line of work?
You know, it's kind of funny, but I think when I was 11, we had a calf born on a pretty bad day, and I brought it in the house and warmed it up and you know, gave it a bottle and things like that. So he lost his mom, so it's a little orphan calf. And I love caring for livestock. And I guess from that point on, I knew I wanted to raise cattle. And I found out, though, over time, what I really love is caring for the land and for the type of land we have, at least at this point. Ruminant animals like cattle or goats or sheep are a really big part of that. And it's the best way we've found to care for the kind of land we have.
And so to that end, what kind of food do you grow and you know, animals do you raise? Do you have a wide array or?
You know, we're really not. We're primarily beef cattle. So we have a cow-calf, what's called a beef cow-calf operation. Mm-hmm. And those calves will graze for some time and then they'll spend a short point of their life still in a more traditional feedlot setting, you know, the last couple of months of their life where they're finished out to the certain standards that, you know, a high-quality choice product. But the cows and the cows spend their whole lives on grass, and then the calves every year spend a little bit more of their lives on it. We're trying to find ways to graze longer, but it's not always, you know, it's finding that sweet spot in the market is what we try to do.
What kind of practices do you implement in the, you know, specifically that are kind of outlined and championed in this report?
Sure. I'd say a few things we've learned that have really paid off. One, we use a practice called integrated pest management, which means that, you know, years ago, the common practice was simply to spray everything and kill all the weeds. And when you really look at that, it certainly doesn't make sense in what Mother Nature would have done. So, first of all, we only spray a weed if it's a problem. Mm-hmm. So, selective management there. We've incorporated legumes into all our pastures so that we basically have the ability to produce our own nitrogen instead of having to buy synthetic nitrogen that can go on and cause other problems. It's, once again, just following nature's lead. And that's a great, not only an ecological solution, but an economical one as well, in that it, you know, it saves me considerable money on input costs and also makes a much better quality forage. So the cool thing that happens is now, since we've quit spraying so much, we've got this great diversity in our pastures, and it's brought back wonderful birds, and it's brought back plants and species that we haven't seen for a long, long time around here. And that's kind of exciting to see, I guess, for lack of better words, how forgiving Mother Nature really is if you give her a chance.
Has this always been the way that you have, that, you know, on your family's land, that you have, you know, your approach to farming, or has it kind of changed over the years?
No, it's evolved over time. We went through in 98, we had a really, really bad blizzard. And up until that point, I'd really tried to do things, I don't know how you say it, the way the industry expected you to do things, you know, and in that case, it was more dependence on chemicals, more dependence on really intensive management that required more antibiotics. It was more dependence on, you know, one of the practices was calving cows in February that it just doesn't seem like a real natural thing to do, but if everyone's telling you to do it, you do.
Mm-hmm.
And
this
blizzard hit, and it was calving season, and everyone worked very, very hard, and it was something that I didn't like seeing the cows go through. I didn't like seeing my helpers go through. I didn't like it, and I decided at that point, and I was young enough to make a decision like that, I just decided that I was going to build a system that gave me happy cows, clean water, and healthy soil, and a system that was focused on stewardship instead of production. My feelings were that if all the experts were right and I went broke, I was okay with that because I felt like I was doing right by the cows and I was doing right by the land, and so be it. I could only sleep at night with that decision. And instead what happened is we actually became more profitable, and we saw a slight production increase because we were paying attention to Mother Nature and focusing on stewardship. I think a lot of it in agriculture, we have this huge pressure to focus on production, but when you look at what farms really are, farms are living systems, and living systems, when you manage living systems, you have to focus on doing a lot of little things well. Living systems are sustained by natural resources, and when you start focusing on protecting those natural resources instead of worrying about production, what I found is other things fall into place.
So taking a more of a longer-term approach than short-term thinking.
Yeah, you do. You have to take, that's a great way of putting it. It's I hope no one goes into farming to get rich. I mean, it's an oversupply business for one. But I think the important thing goes back again, when we focus on caring for those resources that really sustain our farms, rainfall, soil, sunlight, you know, human ingenuity, things start to work out. And a lot of times when managed properly,
these resources
do allow the products I produce to actually find optimum levels.
So I'm wondering if since 1998 you have felt you've kind of doubted your decision to move in a more sustainable direction, and you felt like you wanted to kind of give in to some of these pressures to simply just expand the farm and do, you know, implement practices that would encourage growing the farm rather, you know, operating at a sustainable level that was healthier for the land and the animals.
Yeah. Since 98, we have focused on caring for the land. Now, what we have seen, though, is we've actually been able to maintain our production and actually increase it a little bit, just because other things are falling into place in a better way.
So you haven't felt like you know, you haven't kind of wanted to reverse that decision at any point? Like,
okay, there, I got you.
Yeah.
No, I have not. The hardest thing, the only thing that has been really hard for us has been more since about 2008, especially with the renewable fuel standard and some things with farming in general, and part of its demographic. There's been huge pressure placed on farmers to raise more corn, regardless of the type of land they have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the best way I can describe this, now we're in a part of Iowa that is very steep, ancient soils, very erodible land. We're not really well suited for it yet. The farm bill tries to be kind of one size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I put this, like if someone is north of us in the Des Moines Lobe and some of those really rich productive areas, I think that, and I, if I lived up there, I would raise corn and as much as I could, because it's really a perfect area for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the sad thing is that for some reason, our farm bill does not seem to recognize that not every part of Iowa is perfect for raising corn. Mm-hmm. And the pressure that I faced more so, we would like to expand and raise more cattle and be able to graze our calves longer, but that takes more land. And we have kind of an artificial competition on some of this very marginal ground because there are incentives and there are programs in place to encourage raising corn instead of grazing.
I have a question. So about when the cow reaches maturity or the point at which, it is going to be, processed, you said they spend, their last kind of time in a feedlot. Mm-hmm. What is that like a confined, is that what we think of as a CAFO?
We run open pens and they're not, you know, it's not confinement. It's the best way we've got to do it right now is how I would describe that. My favorite scenario, if we had the space and the land, would be to simply let the cattle run out and feed them some grain while they're grazing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty much a standard. There's things. It's interesting to me to see the things we've learned over the years. Just from the way you care for the lots and put bedding down and things like that, some husbandry skills that really help with it. But it's a scenario that fits for what we do right now. I think the thing that I always talk about, sustainability, is about continuous improvement. So as I study this and look at what we see going forward, and I see some of the expectations of consumers, whether it's Walmart who wants to take a gigaton of carbon out of the supply chain, or it's McDonald's that wants to be antibiotic free. I think we're going to see scenarios where we graze those calves on cover crops and things like that longer. I think we're going to see some scenarios where just grazing in general is going to have to come into play. And I like that, personally, but at the same time, that's where we're at right now.
Right. Absolutely. And then do you know where your animals go after they are processed, or do you have visibility to that step in the supply chain?
No, I really don't. I know that they go to different, different packers, get the bids and mm-hmm. buy them, and then they go on into, I know that ours go into a higher end market.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that, I've thought about this a lot. There are incredible efficiencies with the system we have. I mean, and I've seen that in terms, one of the things that I do appreciate is there isn't any waste within, a packing plant or things like that. They find product to use and things to do with the calves that sometimes when we've tried to go at a local level and process our calves locally and go into those local markets, we've had a lot of waste. And I hate seeing that. I feel like, A, the calf should only have one bad day.
Mm-hmm.
And B, I feel like it's not doing right by that calf if we don't use everything that's there in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been really... That part of it, I guess I see as a positive. I would love to figure out a way that we could have more, a way that the calves, could be killed at home or closer to home.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get into the scheme of keeping the end product, the meat affordable and the other products you use and things like that, right now I guess what's important is that we just keep working on ways that would make sure that the animals are handled properly and in a manner that, is not stressful to them and some of those things first. That's kind of my priority.
Absolutely.
And then on, selling the meat too, it's I think one thing that is good is that what we sell is very safe.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean we can't find better ways to do it would be the best way I'd say that. And someday maybe grass-fed will become more and more dominant, too, as a market. Right now, we kind of see 50-50 on that with people, what they like and don't like.
And that was
things to work at.
That's something that I wanted to ask to both of you in terms of consumer purchasing practices and consumer demand. So, Seth, I'm wondering for you personally, have you seen an uptick in the support from like a consumer side or even like a retail side for products that are your animals that are grown in a certain way, so sustainably?
I'm seeing more. On a larger scale, I am seeing more consumer expectation for these things. And that's good. I always say that when we really start talking about our food system will change with consumers' expectations and their demands. And obviously, we see the growth in these markets.
Mm-hmm.
The part I really struggle at with personally, and like I said earlier, I didn't get into farming to get rich because it's not that kind of business.
Mm-hmm.
I just struggle with some of the people I know that don't have super high income, and I want to make sure that really make a difference in my life, like the nurse that took care of my mom when she was in the nursing home, or the paraprofessional that helps my son. These are people that don't make a lot of money, but they're great people. And I know they can't afford to go to the store and pay $16 to $30 a pound for beef.
Mm-hmm.
But they can go into our local supermarket and get a really good product for an average of $5 or $6 a pound. There's no question in my mind there's some externalities that go with that. That's a whole other discussion per se. But I guess I just want to make sure those people I really care about can always have a good, safe, affordable product. I could see a time as we get better at grazing and better at the distribution that maybe they will be able to go buy that product at an affordable price. But right now, it just seems like that premium, as much as I'd like to capitalize on it myself, I feel like it wasn't fair to those people I really cared about.
I think the solution is more of a direct-to-consumer, farm-to-consumer operation. Sort of cutting out some of the middlemen. I'm totally biased because I happen to work for a startup that is doing just that. It's kind of cutting out the middleman. It's an online farmers market, and we connect consumers directly to farmers and growers in a way that is, kind of eliminates a lot of it, that makes the supply chain very short. And so I'm hoping I firmly believe that that's an opportunity to be able to get consumers more affordable, higher quality, food in a way that benefits, the growers and the consumers.
I think it is. And I think it goes down to, once again, to the issue is finding a way to process that calf. So, one of the meat's only when you get said and done, you're only talking about half the weight of the animal's meat.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can find a way to use all those other products, then I think it can really be done. And it can be. And I think that's sometimes, though, what we don't always think about on that end. Because I'd love to, I think it'd be awesome if I could do something like that. One of the tough things we face, too, of course, in the country is just access to enough customers to make it work, so to speak. And then one of the things we've run into on that, when we have direct market, it is, I've said, well, would you accept a frozen product? Because when going back to working with Mother Nature, a lot of people want this fresh meat every single month.
Mm-hmm.
Yet that really goes against the laws of nature in terms of my supply chain, because we really need to have calves on the warm spring days, which means, a year and a half later, we'll have lots of meat available in, say, August or September. And then, but what we've run into in the past is someone saying, well, I want fresh, not frozen.
Right.
And then I'm kind of like trying to figure out how to manage that part of the supply chain. It doesn't mean it can't be done, but it gets into kind of an unnatural setting. Then,
right,
right. Nothing's easy, unfortunately.
Nope, that's true. We do sell frozen.
Yeah, and if people are good with frozen, man, I can really work with them, and that's a way to make that work.
Kara, I want to know, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to ask you kind of your perspective. You write in the report that consumers are really expressing an increased preference for this kind of sustainably produced food. And my question is, like, are they really? Like, what evidence have you seen, to support that statement?
Yes. So since 1997, the demand for organic food has gone up 10 times, so that the organic market is now a $39 billion a year market.
Mm-hmm.
And a majority of Americans buy organic some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think most Americans are probably like me, and they don't always buy organic, right?
Right.
But most Americans do buy organic some of the time. So there are clearly Americans out there who care about where their food comes from and what's on their food. So the problem is what Seth is saying is the expense. But something we point out in the report is how much taxpayers are paying to have food filled with pesticides. So we're paying for it through water cleanup, through increased cost of fish because fish are dying, we're paying for it through putting all these subsidies into making, you know, this renewable fuel standard that's actually causing more greenhouse gases. And this is billions of dollars a year to the American taxpayer. So there are things we could be doing to decrease the cost to the taxpayer while increasing the availability of sustainable food.
I love that. Okay, so we only have time for a couple more questions. I would love to continue this conversation forever. My first of the final few questions that I have is that, you know, the reality for most Americans is that we're busy and, you know, we don't really know how to cook or prioritize it or whatever. I mean, the upshot is that most people eat out quite a bit, certainly more than they ever have in the past. So is there an opportunity for consumers, is there like a happy medium or an opportunity for consumers who do eat out quite a bit of the time to support these kinds of sustainable farming practices through the food that they, you know, through voting with their fork? Like, how do you marry those two realities?
Yes. So I think you're asking if you eat out a lot, how do you influence the kind of food that you're buying? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, my question was a little convoluted. That's exactly right. I mean, like, the reality is that people eat out a lot. And so how do we actually move the needle on some of these issues to encourage people to continue to purchase sustainably produced food if they really eat out? Like, is there a happy medium?
Well, believe it or not, there's actually a lot you can do as a consumer at restaurants to make a huge impact on our food production system. So, for example, in the area of antibiotics, we've seen huge movement in the past 3 to 4 years. Because of consumer demand, McDonald's, Subway, Panera have all agreed to stop using chicken raised without the routine use of antibiotics. And, you know, right now we're trying to get them to, we're trying to get McDonald's to stop using beef raised with the routine use of antibiotics. And I mean, that has been huge just because of consumer pressure.
Yeah.
Just in a few years.
Absolutely. And that's a huge impact, right? In terms of scale. That's absolutely right. Okay. Final couple of questions relate to the committee hearing. What was the reaction to your report? And then I want to know where the pushback came from. How was it received?
The idea behind releasing our report when we did is that we want to get this data out there in one place so that, you know, average people and lawmakers can go to it and say, okay, here's everything that we need to be addressing with the food system. And so some lawmakers on Wednesday at this hearing where they were talking about agriculture and the future of chemicals in agriculture, they used it to ask questions to people like, you know, the head of the Cattlemen's Association, for example, the American Cattlemen's Association. And I think that in that way, it was good that it was out there and could be used by certain senators. But yeah, definitely other people, they don't want to hear that we need a change in our food system, which isn't a surprise, I think, to me or to probably many of your listeners, that there's going to be some resistance.
No, definitely not. Any senators in particular who we can, just have awareness of who we're giving pushback to these really important facts and figures and the reality of our agricultural system? Let's just call them out.
Like the actual people themselves?
Yes. Anyone that we should have on our radar to lobby, for instance, as constituents?
I would say, actually, rather than calling out just specific people, I would say everyone should be lobbying their representative and their senators right now about this, because as much as I cared about the Environment and Public Works hearing on this issue, I care more about the final vote on the farm bill that's going to be coming out sometime, hopefully this year. And every senator, every representative is going to be involved in some way, shape, or form in that vote. And if they don't hear from the their average constituent that they want to see healthier water and healthier farms, then it doesn't really matter what the couple people at the EPW hearing said. It matters what your local lawmaker is going to end up voting on.
Absolutely. Very well said. We're going to have to leave it there. But Kara and Seth, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
You're welcome.
Thank
I enjoyed
you.
It. Thank you.
All right. To read the report, Reaping What We Sow, you can find it on PIRG's website, which is uspirgedfund.org. I want to give a big thanks to our supporters for their generous support, as well as our big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as our engineer, Vitor Hirsch. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and let us know what you think. Leave us a comment. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.